Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Santa Fe Psych. I'm Ryan Keith.
And I'm Ryan Barbeau.
In this, the latest entry in our Ask an Expert series, Dr. Barbeau will again help me in answering some of your questions. This time around, we're tackling something that many of us know all too well, anxiety. Whether because of money, work, family, or the looming shadow of finals week, we all deal with stress. But what happens when stress gets in the way of everyday life? And what can we do about it? That's where your questions come in. Now, Dr. Barbeau, before we get to questions, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your own experience with anxiety. What makes you stressed?
Well, thanks for having me today. So in terms of what makes me stressed, I guess lots of things make me stressed. Actually, just before we started the recording just now, we were having a conversation about setting up these recordings. And today we're recording live from the Santa Fe recording studio, which actually can be a little bit intimidating. We got these big fancy microphones, and a few months ago we had done a recording, and we actually did that from the comfort of my own home, which the audio recording probably wasn't as good a quality, but it's probably good we did that one first, because I'm a little bit less anxious now, I think, than I might have been otherwise. But throughout my life, I guess different things have made me anxious. Believe it or not, I used to actually get really nervous about giving classroom presentations. But over the course of years being a TA and now a professor, I've done that enough that I guess that's not something I get anxious about anymore. But there's other things that didn't make me anxious when I was younger that do make me anxious now. So I could give lots of other examples, but I'm very familiar with anxiety, not just as a clinician, but also as a human being, as a person.
Yeah, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, we've talked before about how to go through all the school that you went through and to be successful in a competitive graduate program like you were, you kind of have to have some anxiety about all of this stuff to motivate you to get through, right?
Yeah, you know, hopefully I have like an optimal amount of anxiety today so that I'm, you know, not so anxious that I have a panic attack and the interview doesn't go well, but also not, you know, if I didn't have a little bit of anxiety, I probably wouldn't be on my toes and be able to give, you know, good, strong answers to your questions. So I think sometimes it's about being in that optimal range. The goal isn't necessarily to eliminate anxiety completely. It's kind of to channel and harness it and use it in a productive fashion, as opposed to it being kind of paralyzing or kind of handcuffing you.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to hope we're both here in this like kind of optimal level of anxiety to answer some anxiety-related questions. And again, these are questions that other Santa Fe students have submitted about mental health. We talked a little bit about how to do this question and answer session. And rather than answering absolutely everybody's questions all at once, we decided instead to go with a specific theme, take a subset of those questions, and see what all of us are asking about how to get over or deal with stress. So I just want to jump in and start with one of these first questions that we've got, and I'm going to read it right on through. What is one reason why people suffer from anxiety? I know that it's something that is very common that people face daily because I myself suffer from it a lot. In crowds, sleeping, just by myself, I have to deal with it. Is there any way that we can help tolerate it?
Great question. There's a lot in that question, so I'm going to maybe try to take it a little bit piece by piece.
Sure.
And you can tell me if I left any pieces out. But first, in terms of what causes anxiety, so it's an excellent question. And when we look at what causes mental health conditions in general, I like the analogy sort of like a recipe. Over the weekend, I made my daughter and I made muffins. And, you know, you might kind of say, well, what causes a muffin? Well, there's lots of different things that you need in that recipe, right? I mean, you need the eggs, and you need the flour, and you need the sugar, and you need some salt, and you know, whatever else goes into it. So when we talk about mental health conditions like anxiety, there's a lot of different components to it, right? There's kind of, we can think about a biological predisposition. So yes, people are born with kind of a genetic predisposition, their brain, the structure and the function of the brain may be wired in such a way that might make it more or less likely for them to experience anxiety. But there's also going to be environmental factors, social factors, cultural factors, other kind of psychological factors. So I don't know if that helps answer that first part of the question. You know, it's never just one thing that causes anxiety. We might sometimes like to think about one factor that's led to it, but it's really always going to be a combination of different factors.
Sure. In your practice, are there specific things that people talk about causing more anxiety than others, certain factors that you find are more common?
Yeah, absolutely. So throughout the course of my clinical career, I've worked in different settings. So I've worked in the Department of Corrections and community mental health centers and the VA. And currently, in addition to being a professor here at Santa Fe, I do some clinical work at the University of Florida, where I work with college, undergrad, and graduate students. And I guess not surprisingly, a lot of the things that kind of serve as maybe a trigger for their anxiety would be things like tests, things like relationship concerns, things such as what kind of academic major they want to choose, what kind of jobs they want to pursue, things of that nature. Those are just sort of like common anxieties that kind of age and that population usually experiences triggers for anxiety.
Yeah, so it sounds like that the kinds of things that stress everyone out are the sorts of things that are stressful, right? And we'll talk in just a little bit about what happens when that stress comes to impact you on an everyday basis where you have a hard time functioning. But I've got another kind of general question here. I know the last one, there was a lot to it. This one is mm-hmm. a little bit more direct. Does anxiety have an impact on the brain?
Sure. There might be, you know, several different ways to look at this. But in the way, if you think about the brain as, you know, the place where neurons fire and where kind of pathways get developed and habits get formed. So if the brain starts responding to stimuli in an anxious sort of way, that can become kind of more and more likely as that pathway sort of develops over time. So the brain can kind of develop in such a way to make it more and more prone to anxiety. So if a person has experienced one episode of anxiety, other episodes of anxiety might be more likely later on. But the good news is that mechanism sort of works in the opposite direction as well because of, you know, brain plasticity. Just as a person brain can kind of go in a direction of becoming more and more prone to anxiety concerns, there can also be a therapeutic reaction in the other direction where the brain becomes kind of more and more healthy or less and less inclined to respond in kind of that clinical anxiety sort of fashion.
So like, I know not everybody at home listening to this has access to an fMRI or other brain scanner, but would it be fair to say that one way we could think about this would be to say that like anxiety is kind of like a habit that you can build or unbuild?
Sure. It's like if there's a potentially stressful situation, like let's say we have students in a class and you're supposed to give a presentation in front of the class. If leading up to that presentation and during the presentation, we had every student in an fMRI machine, we would see the different parts of the brain light up. And some students who maybe have had concerns or struggles with anxiety might have different parts of the brain lighting up than those students who don't necessarily have some of those same anxiety concerns.
Sure. So it seems like there are a lot of ways that anxiety can impact how your brain works. How about the rest of your body?
Sure. The brain and the body are kind of inextricably intertwined. So you can kind of think about it in terms of almost like a positive feedback loop. So that let's say those things happen in my brain where the amygdala would be like the fear center of the brain, so to speak, kind of roughly speaking. And when that lights up, that might lead to anxiety types of thoughts, you know, thoughts of kind of catastrophizing, thoughts of things going poorly. That will in turn impact the body, right? That will make your breathing more rapid and your palms sweaty. As soon as you realize that your palms are getting sweaty and your heart's beating, that might make those thoughts accelerate. And when those thoughts accelerate, then your heart's going to start beating even faster. And when your heart starts beating even faster, it's going to accelerate those thoughts even more. So it kind of builds and builds and builds. But again, the good news is that any sort of like therapeutic intervention to either, you know, the brain and the mind and thinking or to the body can help as well. The second you realize that your heart isn't beating quite so quickly, you might have thoughts that are sort of more relaxing. And as soon as you have thoughts that are more relaxing, in turn, your kind of physiological body response calms as well. So it's kind of, you can think of that cycle kind of working either kind of in one direction, revving you up, or working in the other direction and sort of calming you down.
You know, and it's interesting to think about it this way. At this point, I know that students listening to this podcast have already read about panic disorder, for example, these recurring panic attacks. And it sounds a little bit like what we're talking about is, again, kind of if you get in a stress habit, And that habit then gets applied to the way you think about your body, you can end up fueling these recurring panic attacks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, you know, published by the American Psychiatric Association, that's used by mental health professionals to diagnose conditions, a single episode of having a panic attack is not a diagnosable thing. It becomes diagnosable when that one episode leads the person to have thoughts, fears, concerns about future episodes, which then starts impacting their daily functioning, making them more likely to avoid things. And then when they do inevitably end up in a situation that does trigger that, they're more likely to have a subsequent panic attack. And when that kind of intensity and duration and chronicity builds and builds and builds, then ultimately have a diagnosable condition. So,
And maybe you can help me out for a second. What does chronicity mean?
Well, yeah, into the clinical jargon. But yeah, it's just sort of a fancy way of saying that when it becomes repeated over time. Having one panic attack isn't really all that problematic. It's sort of the consequences of that in terms of, you know, now the person doesn't want to go to the grocery store anymore because that's where they had, you know, their first panic attack. And then all of a sudden they realize that it's not just grocery stores that they're afraid of triggering a panic attack. It's actually just, you know, a variety of different large buildings. And then it kind of snowballs from there. So yeah, chronic just meaning kind of over time. Repeated over and over again. Like for different DSM conditions, sometimes they specify this has to have been going on for 3 months or 6 months. So unless you've reached that kind of duration of time, we don't really consider it a diagnosable condition, because things like having a panic episode are actually fairly normal. As human beings, that's kind of a way that we're wired, and they're not necessarily bad or abnormal or problematic. They really only become clinically diagnosable once they've become sort of impacting lots of different areas of one's life.
Cool. So as we talk about kind of like moving from these normal things to what we would consider to be disorders, we're actually moving from questions kind of about normal anxiety to questions about anxiety disorders. And there were a lot of questions on anxiety disorders. So I tried to distill them down to either questions that represented a whole group of them or to identify kind of a common topic that hit a lot of these. A couple of people asked this question in some different forms, but kind of on the most basic sense, how do you as a clinician conclude that somebody is suffering from an anxiety disorder?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So like I said, people commonly experience anxiety, and kind of going back for a second, like we said, one of the first things I try to do when I work with people is to try to convey that anxiety is not bad, it's not the enemy, it's not something we would want to completely disappear. If you think kind of evolutionarily, it's a really good adaptive sort of mechanism. You know, a long time ago when we were in the, caveman and cavewoman ages, if there was a wild animal started chasing you, you would want to be able to be capable of having an anxiety response, because that's the fight or flight energy, right, that would allow you to escape the wild animal. And even to this day, it's still useful that we have that, because we might encounter a dangerous situation and we need that surge of adrenaline to help keep us safe. But nowadays, we don't really encounter usually, wild animals attacking us. But things that are kind of threatening to us might be things like a final exam and a course that's really important for the major you want to pursue. The thing is, though, that surge of energy we needed to attack and defeat the wild animal or run away from the wild animal, when you're taking a final exam, the goal is not to smash the computer screen or run out of the testing lab as quickly as possible. So you need some energy in preparation to help you study, and you need some energy while you're taking the exam to focus and do well. But a lot of us, probably because of, you know, evolutionarily how we're designed, we get a little too much anxiety. And sometimes that ends up being paralyzing, and we're not able to perform as well as we possibly could on the exam. So going back to your question, where's that line between what's kind of normal everyday functioning and what's diagnosable? Like I said, the DSM lays out certain criteria. So using another fancy word, sometimes things like how pervasive the condition is. So again, if this is sort of a one-time event, it's probably not going to be something that would be diagnosable. But when it starts to become pervasive, meaning it's not just one particular class where the person is struggling in, it's multiple classes, or it's not just academics, it's also their personal life. So once it starts to kind of really impact the person's quality of life, then we start to think kind of more in diagnostic sort of terms.
Sure, and in that way, you know, I guess in some ways it's about really like who would benefit the most from help and who would benefit the most from intervention, which is, you know, something we'll talk about in a little bit, the kind of interventions we can use.
Sure.
The next question asker is kind of getting us focused on some more specific disorders. This question asker says, I would like to know more about social anxiety. Since most of what I have read is online and you can't believe everything you see on the internet, I'd like to hear more facts and reliable information about this disorder.
Sure. So social anxiety is going to be when the person's anxiety response, instead of being more generalized, is specific more to situations involving other people that kind of serve as the trigger or stir up that anxiety. So it might be that, you know, the person doesn't want to go to restaurants anymore because they're concerned that something embarrassing might happen to them, that they might drop their plate of food, everyone would be looking at them, that would be very embarrassing, that would then impact the you know, their relationships in a negative way, something that they wouldn't like. So it's kind of when it's fueled by that, those kind of interpersonal dynamics, and fueled by a sense of not wanting to be embarrassed and not wanting social situations to go poorly.
And this is another one of these things that sounds really like it's, I mean, kind of a normal thing. If I think about most of my own anxiety, it comes from social situations, right? Like students who've been in my in-person classes, they know me by the fact that I have a beard and I wear a tie every day to class. And, you know, I could pretend like these were just fashion choices I made because I liked them. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of students about the fact that I wore a beard because the first question somebody asked me when I, and the same reason I wear a tie, the first question anybody asked me when I got up to teach my very first class was, you know, are you really the professor and how old are you? So, you know, that caused enough anxiety that I decided, you know, I was going to change a lot of how I looked. Do a lot of your patients experience some level of social anxiety?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I think sometimes it's helpful to realize that it's kind of not the initial response that's maybe all that important. It's kind of what flows from there. You know, so in the example you're talking about, if that resulted in you doing things like, you know, avoiding lectures, and that led to you losing your job, and that led to you then becoming more nervous about subsequent employment opportunities being challenging because inevitably you're going to be surrounded by people and you might not be able to handle those situations well, kind of that snowball effect. So it's not necessarily problematic that you kind of felt uneasy when a student kind of challenged you or questioned you that way. It's sort of like what happened next. Were you either going to go down the pathway of learning to kind of like cope and use that anxiety in a productive fashion, or whether that anxiety is going to lead you down the path of, you know, avoiding things that are going to be meaningful to your life and starting to damage and hurt your quality of life. And when that snowball happens, like I said, that's when a person might benefit more from some kind of clinical intervention, and that's when it might be more appropriate to go ahead and place kind of an official label on something so the person can kind of get a, you know, help in a more formal way to hopefully alleviate those symptoms and get them on that kind of alternative path.
Sure. And I mean that's really the power of a psychological intervention, right? Is that label's not there to hurt anybody or to limit them, but rather to say, you know, what kind of treatment is the most appropriate and will be most effective.
Sure. It's like if you have, you know, knee pain or something like that, if you go to the doctor and they kind of say, oh, yeah, well, it sounds like these are the symptoms you're having, but it might not be it might be more powerful and more kind of instill more hope or optimism if they explain, okay, well, this is the specific thing that appears to be going on here. You have this specific sort of tear, and we've done research to say that these types of interventions are, you know, fairly likely to help. So sometimes, yeah, a label, we have to be careful with labels, right? Sometimes labels can make a person feel worse and make the problem maybe more complicated and harder to treat, but sometimes a label can be therapeutic and helpful. But again, it's probably not like the label per se that's either kind of therapeutic or therapeutic. It's about the relationship that the psychologist has with the patient and how that conversation is had. It's like a hammer isn't good or bad. It depends kind of, you know,
whose hand,
the hand, yeah, and how it's used, exactly.
Exactly. So. Yeah, so thinking about these labels, that the next question asker, it sounds like they've got some experience with this and are experiencing a little bit of confusion about it, highlighting some of the complex nature here. This student asks, I recently was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. My thoughts have been repetitive and it's been difficult to break the cycle. But then my psychologist talked about something called pure OCD. So my question is there even a difference between OCD and pure OCD? And what I would ask to go along with that, as we're talking about pure OCD, what's the connection between that and generalized anxiety disorder?
Yeah, so very good question. First, I would just note that, you know, obviously I'm only able to kind of speak in generalities here. So if students have kind of more personal concerns, just to be aware that there's, you know, resources available to them, like the Santa Fe Counseling Center is free, and there's, you know, providers there that can help. So I wouldn't in this forum kind of try to answer anybody's individual questions. But speaking more generally, when you ask about that, it brings up an interesting point. So I want to answer the question more specifically, but first talk a little bit more broadly. It's important to realize that in some ways, mental health conditions and diagnosing are in some ways different than some types of medical diagnosing. Where in medicine, sometimes we can kind of identify there's certain viruses and certain bacteria that do exist. I mean, we can see them, you know, under a microscope or, you know, through, you know, different biopsies and things like that. So they're kind of more concrete in nature. Mental health diagnosing might eventually be able to get to that point where there's that degree of precision. But at the current time, mental health diagnosing is more about identifying a group of symptoms and finding out the best way to categorize them, the way that's going to be the most useful for researchers and the most useful for clinicians. And that's really no different than other aspects of psychology. You know, if you think about different parenting styles, right, there's like authoritative, authoritarian, and permissive. But those are theoretical constructs. I mean, really, there's an infinite amount of parenting style. You know, every set of parents has a slightly different style. And you could pick five categories you want to use, or three, or seven. We've just, through research and utilization determined that, you know, for parenting, that's kind of a convenient way to look at it. So in some ways, mental health diagnosing is a similar sort of thing. So in different editions of the DSM, DSM 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sometimes conditions that were separate before have been kind of combined under one umbrella, and sometimes conditions that existed under one umbrella have then been separated out. So if you look at actually at anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorders, in DSM-4, they were all grouped together. And in DSM-5, they've been separated out. And when you look at now the diagnosis of OCD, some folks are going to have OCD where they're, you know, the obsessions are the thinking aspect to it, and the compulsions are the behavioral aspect to it. So some folks have the condition where there's the more thinking, the more obsessive aspects of it, but not necessarily as heavy on the compulsions. Sometimes people have more compulsions and not so much the obsessions, and sometimes they have both. It's sort of like if people have heard the term ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In the DSM, there's actually three different types. There's the predominantly inattentive type, which is basically like taking out the H. There's the predominantly hyperactive type, and then there's the sort of combined type. So yes, it's certainly possible that sometimes people have OCD, but they don't have a lot of prominent compulsive behavioral aspects to it. They have more so just the obsessive components to it. And there's a lot of similarities between that and some of the anxiety disorders. Another way to look at kind of the similarities would be, and we'll talk about, I think, treatment more in a second, but if you look at treatments, some of the same medications are going to be prescribed whether the person has, what's labeled as, you know, OCD with more of the obsession concerns or anxiety disorders. It's a similar kind of class and type of medications. And actually, in terms of even the counseling and psychotherapy aspect, it might be a similar set of interventions that are used. So there's, in some ways, more overlap than there is difference. And in that way, too, a lot of times the diagnosis sometimes then isn't all that important. You know, if the same sort of treatments are going to be prescribed either way, then how much does it really matter how it gets labeled and how it gets categorized? And sometimes how it gets labeled and how it gets categorized, we have to also think about it from kind of a, you know, like a political economic sort of standpoint as well, that in some ways, you know, the DSM is a tool that serves several purposes. It serves research purposes, it serves clinical purposes, and it also serves purposes in our current system in terms of insurance reimbursement and things like that. So that is sort of like an angle that you need to look at. So sometimes the diagnosis is also to some degree determined a little bit by the demands of a particular setting in terms of like what's it going to take to get this person help and reimbursement for the help that they need.
Yeah, so if we think about it, you know, obviously it sounds like there are these very practical concerns, right? But it sounds like, you know, like what you're highlighting is in this, you know, more heavy OCD, the obsessions, right? That there might be a relationship, you know, psychologically between these obsessions and what happens to people in generalized anxiety disorder. What is that similarity?
Yeah, so there's a lot of similarities. Sometimes when I meet with a person clinically and I kind of talk to them, do an interview with them, as they explain their condition, and you know, if I look at the DSM or just have in my mind the criteria in the DSM, they're kind of checking all those boxes for something like a generalized anxiety disorder, and that diagnosis is pretty simple and straightforward. Sometimes they might be reporting things that are kind of more OCD related.
Oh, and just real quick, sorry for cutting in. If you had to give like a one sentence summary of generalized anxiety disorder for anyone who, for example, didn't have a chance to finish reading the chapter that they were supposed to read yet, what would that be like?
Good question. Yeah. So here's another kind of fancy clinical word, pervasive. And pervasive just means that it exists in more than one setting. So as opposed to it being a specific, like there's all sorts of different specific phobias. You could have a specific phobia of spiders or snakes or anything of that nature. And generalized is when it's actually really hard to find a place where the person's not anxious. So sometimes people are anxious in work settings, but not at home, or they're anxious in home settings, but not at work. But generalized anxiety, it's sort of pervasive in that sense that no matter what setting we put the person in, probably that anxiety is going to stir up.
Yeah, so sorry for cutting off, but you were just about to get to the, like, what do obsessions have to do with this stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I guess one of the ways to explain the differences between kind of the conceptually what anxiety looks like and obsessions look like is sometimes with obsessions there can be pretty good insight into the fact that, and actually really not wanting those thoughts to occur, but the thoughts just keep coming back, so it's sort of that like lack of control of those thoughts. But like I said, sometimes it is kind of challenging to differentiate between them, and actually the DSM even allows for some wiggle room. So for every condition like anxiety or like OCD, there's actually two separate categories that they call like an unspecified or a specified, because sometimes all the criteria is not necessarily met, or sometimes there just hasn't been enough time to kind of figure out and kind of how to differentiate the two. So really it kind of all depends on what the person is reporting, what's seen as kind of problematic, and kind of just the nature in terms of how it manifests.
Awesome. No, thanks for helping clarify. So talking about these kinds of comparisons, less between disorders, more talking about among people, with this next question, I got a lot of questions that touched on this kind of like core idea, though they were asked in different ways. Are men and women different in terms of rates of anxiety disorders, which ones they're more likely to experience? I'm sure that there are lots of specific differences, but maybe you could give us an idea. What are some of the trends in terms of differences between men and women?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So if we look at the rates or the prevalence of different mental health conditions, some are experienced more, or at least diagnosed more in males, some are experienced or diagnosed more in females. So it brings up a really interesting question about why are there different rates? So are there different rates because of some biological difference that exists between males and females? Is it some kind of environmental or cultural difference that leads to different rates? Also, sometimes maybe the rates of difference is not so much that men and women experience different amounts of it, but in terms of seeking services. You know, if one of the genders is less likely to see a counselor or a psychologist for a particular concern, they're going to end up with lower rates of that condition, but it doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't exist. It just means that they haven't been diagnosed as often.
So, like, I was in a class recently, and I mean just last week, and we were talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, right? And I know that when most people think about post-traumatic stress disorder, they think about like combat veterans, but we also know that there are high prevalence rates among first responders, and that things like accidents or, you know, really, if we're going to talk about prevalence, of course, domestic violence, right, can produce a lot of PTSD. And yet, some of my students were really surprised that prevalence rates in the U.S. Seem to top out at about 7%, right?
Sure. No, it's a really good question. And, you know, technically in the DSM, PTSD is actually one of those things that's separated out. But it makes a lot of sense to talk about, you know, anxiety, OCD, PTSD altogether, because, again, there's some of these kind of underlying mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the DSM, there's actually something called post-traumatic stress disorder, and then there's something called acute stress disorder. And actually, the criteria is the same. The main difference between the two is just the duration. So a person only meets criteria for a PTSD diagnosis if it's lasted for six months. So a lot of times, too, something traumatic will happen. The person will have reactions that are similar to what people might think of about PTSD. But if it doesn't last for 6 months, it's not technically going to be diagnosed as PTSD. And an interesting thing about the traumas, too, is that two people could experience the same exact trauma but have different responses. So going back to the piece about gender, it's actually interesting. If you look at something like sexual assault, or rape, that when that happens to a female, they have a fairly high likelihood of developing PTSD. But actually, a male who is sexually assaulted or raped has a higher rate of that developing into PTSD. And if we look at something like violence, like being robbed at gunpoint or being, you know, physically assaulted, when that happens to a male, yes, they may develop PTSD, but the female in that situation actually has a much higher likelihood of it developing into PTSD. So it's almost like if you think about it from that cultural perspective, again, there could be different theories and different hypotheses, but one of the, you know, a compelling way to look at it is sort of that, you know, the way our culture works, as traumatic as it might be for a male to experience violence, men kind of are raised in such a way that they know that sometimes men act violently and they're a male and they might be in that situation and they might get attacked, where it comes as a much bigger shock or surprise or potentially trauma for a female, because females aren't really raised to, in our culture, to believe that violence is going to be a part of their everyday life.
And we could say the same, well, inverse about like sexual assault, right? That this is something that is not, you know, expected. And in fact, you might feel really personally, emotionally, even in terms of your personality, victimized if you're somebody who's male and sexually assaulted, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, sadly, a lot of females in our society experience various forms of, you know, sexual assault and even rape, and they're likely to, while growing up, know people that this has happened to. So if it happens to them, that certainly puts them at risk. But in some ways, it's a bit protective, sadly, that it's so sort of prevalent that it won't come as such a shock to them, because sadly, it happens fairly often. Where for males, it happens less often, and it's perhaps more stigmatized, even less talked about. So if you're a male and you have this experience, it's potentially more shocking, more terrifying. This wasn't sort of something you ever really thought about or prepared for in your life, therefore having higher rates of PTSD. So it's interesting to look at, you know, from that perspective, if the culture was different, maybe you wouldn't see those kind of discrepant rates. So it's kind of fascinating to see kind of how culture shapes people's reactions to events and therefore leads to different prevalence rates for similar experiences and things like that.
So it's interesting, as you're talking about prevalence rates, this kind of nicely leads me into the next question, helps us create a bridge here to our, kind of our last section as we talk about treatment. This question asker says, research has shown that mental health issues are common among college students, and we know this. Anxiety disorder rates, right, for example, are much higher among college students than the general population. But they go on to say, many of them do not get help due to the stigma attached to the subject. What are the options available to students in case they want to get help?
Sure. So that's a great question. So like I mentioned before, you know, Santa Fe students are fortunate. There's a really good free option, the counseling center. For people who aren't, in most colleges and universities have, you know, free counseling centers that are paid for by their student fees. For people that aren't college or university students, there's usually other options available in the community. Like in our community here, we have the Alachua County Crisis Center, so that provides free services for folks. There's also a community mental health centers. So we have Meridian Behavioral Healthcare Center that provides, you know, low cost and or free services for folks. And then there's also obviously options that exist at, you know, the university. So the University of Florida has, you know, various providers that offer different psychiatric and psychological services. And then there's also people in private practice in the community as well. So there's lots of options available. What sometimes can be challenging is, you know, and this gets into kind of, you know, other kind of economics and politics, but, you know, the way those services are going to be, you know, paid for and kind of whether a person has insurance or not and things like that. But those are kind of, you know, beyond the scope of this discussion. But yeah, those kind of can make it complicated in terms of there are services available, but access to care may be challenging for some mm-hmm. folks depending on their socioeconomic status and other factors like that.
Sure, absolutely. And I mean, definitely that when I was a college student, I took advantage of the free counseling services. And it's something that I realize now, given the cost associated with it, especially if your insurance won't cover, that it's a really nice thing that our students have. As we talk about therapy here, I've got another question from a student who says, I struggle with anxiety very badly. I also struggle with depression very badly. That's not a focus of our talk here, but these two go hand in hand a lot in that sense of comorbidity. And the student says, when I talk with a counselor, all they focus on is, how does that make you feel? And this has been no help to me. What are some ways that I can battle this?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So first, in terms of the similarities between anxiety and depression, I remember one of my professors in grad school used to say they're just opposite sides of the same coin. And when you kind of think about it, it makes sense that if a person is anxious for long enough, that kind of depression can set in. And if a person is depressed enough, kind of inevitably some anxiety will flip in as well. So it's almost just sort of what that person is experiencing more at the time. And if you look at biological interventions, the kind of, you know, standard of care from a medical sort of sense is an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So again, anxiety, depression have kind of similar, mm-hmm. you know, biomedical mm-hmm. treatments. But going to the question about the person said, talking said they get the response sure. of like, how does that make you feel?
And I know a lot of people feel like this when they think about like what their experience with a psychologist might be. They imagine that it's mostly going to be that, right?
Yeah. So if you think about, you know, in any kind of general psychology course, we'll be introduced to the different perspectives within psychology. So there's the humanistic perspective, there's the psychodynamic perspective, there's the cognitive behavioral perspective, and other perspectives as well. So it sounds like, you know, that idea of asking a person how it makes them feel is more kind of certain interventions would be kind of categorized as sort of like active interventions versus insight-oriented interventions. So asking somebody how that makes them feel is kind of more of a non-directive or insight-oriented intervention, which is probably coming from a kind of a humanistic perspective or a psychodynamic perspective. And sometimes that's what's going to be really helpful for a person. But sometimes a person may benefit more from an action-oriented perspective or intervention, kind of maybe one of the more kind of cognitive behavioral interventions, where they're not necessarily just trying to sort of get to those kind of deeper feelings in the root of it or exploring childhood, but sort of what can we do now? So what are your thoughts like now? What are your behaviors like now? Let's see if we can make any modifications to your thoughts, modifications to your behaviors. So that's kind of really the challenge, I think, of counseling or psychotherapy, is having that good fit between the provider and the patient, so that you're on the same page and you're approaching things in a way that's going to be the most helpful. Because sometimes certain people with certain conditions benefit, again, more from kind of an action-oriented approach. And sometimes people benefit more from an insight-oriented approach. An analogy I'll give real quick, it's like if you're trying to get in better shape physically and you ask your medical doctor, you know, what's the best form of exercise? Is it biking or running or swimming? It's like those can all be good forms of exercise. What's best is what you're going to be the most likely to do. And that's really what the research shows. Various forms of counseling and psychotherapy can all be effective, but it needs to be one that the person feels comfortable with, that they're going to persevere through, that they're going to continue with, that they're going to implement. So it's really about that kind of goodness of a fit, I think.
And if someone, for example, is talking with a counselor or a therapist, right, and really feels that the approach that the therapist is using isn't benefiting them as much as they'd like, what do you think is usually a good step for that person to take?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the best first step would actually be to explore that with your provider, you know, to go ahead and talk to them about that. Most providers these days would consider themselves to be kind of integrative or eclectic, meaning they're trained in all these different approaches, humanistic, psychodynamic, cognitive, and behavioral. So usually they have some flexibility and they probably want to provide the intervention that's going to be most helpful for you. But if you don't have a kind of transparent, open dialogue and discussion with them, they might not know that they need to kind of shift directions. It's sort of like if you go to see a personal trainer, and they always want you to warm up using the exercise bike, but there's just something about being on the exercise bike that you hate where you wouldn't mind, you know, going for a jog or using the treadmill. If they might be more than happy to switch and let you warm up on the treadmill or let you warm up in the pool, but if you don't bring it up and talk to them about it, there won't be that opportunity for change. You know, there might be some providers who are purists who only want to do things from a humanistic perspective. But nowadays, that's fairly rare. Most providers aren't so kind of dogmatic in that they only want to stick with one intervention. They're probably flexible and happy to change direction, but you just need to explore that with them. Of course, if you try to explore that with them and they feel like they're not responsive, then you might want to have a larger discussion about, is this relationship working or might there be other options and things like that. But I think a first step would be just to kind of bring it up and explore that with them. I know if I was working with a patient and there was something about the fit that didn't feel right for them, I definitely would want them to, you know, to ask me about it, because I'd be happy, if at all possible, to be flexible and adjust my approach for them.
So it sounds a little bit like what you're saying is that, contrary to what popular media, movies, and TV shows show us, psychologists are not, in fact, mind readers, right? That you actually have to talk to them about stuff, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. And perhaps some of that dates back to kind of the origins of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, where, you know, Freud would have his patients, you know, lie on a couch and free associate, and he would sit back and say barely anything for a long period of time, and then eventually would come up with this, you know, grand interpretation about what was going on. And in that ways, it did reflect a sort of view that the provider, you know, the psychiatrist was sort of, you know, all-knowing or was going to dispense some wisdom that was going to help the patient. Where now psychotherapy has kind of emerged and progressed, and it's seen as kind of a more collaborative exercise, which, you know, is more empowering for the patient and sees the patient as an important kind of teammate in the process, and kind of an acknowledgement that, yeah, that, you know, psychologists are trained in a certain set of skills and techniques, but mind reading isn't one of those techniques.
Sure.
You know, it takes, you know, you can only be as helpful as the person is willing to open up and share and work collaboratively with you.
Yes, as useful as it would be to be a mind reader. Yeah. So I've got another big question here that a lot of people have asked, again, in one form or another. And I know you're not a psychiatrist, but you can probably speak to this one too. Would you recommend taking prescription medication for anxiety? There are a number of people who asked this question. They had their own concerns, or their family members had concerns, or even in one case, it was a teacher of the student's child who had concerns about medications. As a psychologist, what's your perspective?
Sure, that's a great question. Like the answer to a lot of questions is it depends, but I can maybe try to explain or clarify kind of what it depends on. Mm-hmm. So to go back to kind of a medical analogy again, let's say a person has high blood pressure. So the question would be, should they be on medication for their high blood pressure? Well, it sort of depends on a variety of factors, right? Like how high is the blood pressure? How long has it been high? What's the family history? What has the person tried to do for the blood pressure in the past? Because, you know, medications come with side effects. So I think probably the standard reasonable response to that would be, let's try to resolve the high blood pressure through diet and exercise. If after a good effort to resolve it through diet and exercise, it hasn't resolved, then it might be useful to have a conversation about bringing some medication into the equation to help with that. So I think similar with anxiety. if through lifestyle change, through counseling, through some psychotherapy, we can resolve the anxiety without taking a medication, I think that's preferable because medications do have side effects. But if the person, like I said, has given a good effort over an extended period of time to address the anxiety without utilizing medications, and there's still enough symptoms of anxiety that are disruptive enough to their life, they might want to consider the pros and cons of medications. It's, again, I'm not a psychiatrist, but speaking broadly about medications, it's useful also to look at different types of medications. So there's things, the benzodiazepines, things like Xanax, work really quickly to make a person's anxiety disappear pretty rapidly, but there's a higher risks associated with things like Xanax. A person can develop tolerance and dependence pretty quickly, and you know there's that addiction potential. So so those definitely, you know, a person should be very concerned about. But there might be some potentially appropriate uses for them, but they're going to be more short term. We get you know more concerned if the person's trying to take those longer terms. Kind of analogous to some of the pain medications. Let's say if a person's had a surgery and they're just going to take those pain medications for a day or two or a week after the surgery, that's one thing. But once we see a person stuck on pain medications for a longer period of time, that kind of negative concerning cycle could develop. The other kind of medications that are used for anxiety, and particularly these are good if it's a kind of a longer term anxiety, or the SSRIs that we kind of mentioned before. And those don't really come with any concern about addiction. People, yeah, the brain is going to adjust to any kind of medication that's taking, but SSRIs don't have the same kind of like addiction potential as something like Xanax. So those are a much safer medication to be taking if a person needs to have some medication for anxiety.
Absolutely. You know, and I think you know, there are a lot of clinicians who would say exactly this, that it all depends, right? And that in a lot of cases, I mean, this is the same case if you're getting medication for anything else. You want to be working with a professional who knows you and knows your situation and can give advice on the best way to use these tools.
Right? Sure, absolutely. Right.
Yeah, so this actually brings us down to our last question. And I was really interested seeing this since I felt like it was in some ways like the most powerful and purest distillation of everyone's thoughts about this. Can anxiety be cured?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I guess in some ways it depends on what you mean by cured. If you mean it in the sense that can someone meet DSM criteria at some point in their life and then at some later point in their life not meet DSM criteria, then sure. Anxiety conditions, other mental health conditions get cured all the time. And, you know, if a person, though, you know, there's brain plasticity and the person's brain is going to change over the course of their lifetime. So, yeah, if we look at certain statistics, you know, if you've experienced a mental health condition like anxiety in the past, you're always going to be at a slightly higher risk of future episodes of it. But that doesn't necessarily apply to everyone. Actually, it might be that maybe you had some struggles with anxiety at some point in your life, but in response to that, you've actually developed such strong, powerful, good, you know, coping mechanisms going forward. You might actually be at a lower risk of future episodes of anxiety than the average person, so to speak. So something like anxiety or OCD or PTSD or really any of the conditions we've talked about today, a person should definitely have a lot of optimism and a lot of hope and things like that. You know, if we compare that to something like, Alzheimer's or something like that, there are some conditions, mental health conditions in the DSM that are chronic conditions that we really don't have a cure for and we have to help a person cope. But no one should ever think that an anxiety condition or an OCD condition or a PTSD condition, or like I said, even a depression condition needs to be lifelong. There's certainly a lot of really helpful, you know, interventions and forms of help we have for people. So like I said, I think that, yeah, I definitely would, you know, as a kind of take-home message, encourage people to, you know, if that's something they struggle with, to have optimism, have hope, you know, get some help. And there's, you know, every reason to believe that they can kind of persevere and emerge, you know, a stronger, you know, person for it at the end.
Yeah. So like, what stress happens all the time, right? We have to deal with stressful situations, but you don't have to feel like you're controlled by it. That if somebody were to go see a therapist, for example, you can expect to get better and get to a point where you've got the mental tools to handle these situations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even kind of from a from an existential sort of perspective, these are kind of the things, these challenges, if they're responded to well, coped with well, they can kind of really build a person's, you know, character, even sort of build a person's mental health. So, and if you look kind of from a language point of view, in certain languages, the word crisis actually has sort of a dual meaning. So it's kind of like if you say aloha, it can mean hi or goodbye, depending on the context. So in some languages, crisis has a dual meaning, and it can be used also to convey the, a sense of opportunity. So a lot of times that's one of the first steps I take with somebody who comes to see me for anxiety or OCD or trauma, is to say, I know you're experiencing a crisis right now, maybe some kind of anxiety crisis or some other condition. But maybe a first step is for us to see this as a sort of opportunity, that if we respond well to this, you can emerge on the other side of this actually stronger, more resilient than if you didn't have this sort of thing. Because initially, usually they're thinking, I wish this didn't happen. I could just want this to go away. And I said, maybe that's actually not the most helpful way to look at it. Maybe this is something, you know, a growing pain, so to speak, but something that's going to be actually, you know, 20 years from now, you're going to look back on this and say, yeah, I did have that crisis where, you know, I had a bunch of anxiety. I needed to get some help. But boy, I sure am glad that happened, because now look where that's kind of propelled me to be.
And that's great. I think this is a great thing for us to keep in mind as we come up toward the end of the semester and look at, you know, final exams, final papers, things like that. Thank you a lot for taking the time to answer questions and share your experience as a clinician here. I feel like, you know, I know more about anxiety than I did when we got started, and I'm excited to be able to answer some of these questions.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So thanks a lot. That is our most recent episode of Santa Fe Psych. Look for more episodes like this, where we ask experts about their areas of expertise. Again, Dr. Ryan Barbeau teaches here with us at Santa Fe College, teaches general psychology, developmental psychology, personality psychology, and abnormal psychology. So if you're interested in any other psychology classes, you know who to look for.